pleasure to me and a great honor to be able to open this session organized by the Forum on the History of Physics, which is celebrating and commemorating 50 years of Anderson localization. As the first act in this celebration, I will ask Phil please to stand and be recognized. Now, before the first speaker is introduced, I will get Gloria to come up and take the chair to keep the first speaker under control.
Whatever you say. How do I? Oh, all right.
All you need to do.
You want to be, let's see, you want to be here.
No, I want to be back.
Yeah, okay. Well, I have the honor to introduce the organizer of this session. We did sponsor it, but David Thallis has done the work, and I'm holding the clock, and I've forgotten your title, so I guess you're going to tell us.
It's up on there, so you don't need to read it.
Okay. So, you want to turn your pocket in?
No.
They want us to do the tie.
Yes, of course.
And
I don't wear a tie otherwise.
You could also put it in your collar if you
That's too close to the inner collar. Tie's okay. About the right distance. Is that fine? Okay. Terrible when one gets these things wrong and there's feedback that destroys everything. The title I am giving is The Anderson Localization in the 70s and Beyond. There are two reasons for that, despite if you count back 50 from 2009, you get back to indeed to 1 year after the publication of the paper. But as I will show you in a minute, that the importance of the Anderson paper on localization was not widely understood for the first 10 years.
I'm told I put the microphone on you upside down, for which I apologize.
Okay. Now there may be too much. In honor of my dubious title as a historian, I looked up Science Citation Index to see that my feeling that people really didn't know a lot about Phil's paper at the time I came into the subject in 1969. I knew Phil very well, but I don't think he ever told me about this stuff. And I looked up the citations. The paper called Absence of Diffusion in Certain Random Lattices addressed two problems, both the spin diffusion, which somehow got somewhat neglected initially, and electrical conduction in the semiconductor impurity band. I found 23 citations in the first 6 years after publication, and another 8 to the end of 1967, which doesn't really make it look like a high-impact paper, although Science Citation Index did not have such complete coverage in those days that it does now. But there was there's a fact that a number of those people who did cite it were very distinguished people, Pierre-Gilles de Gennes, and a large number of other people that I have had good reason to know. But most significantly, there were 3 citations by Mott in those early years and another 4 in the remaining years of the first decade, or 11 years or whatever it was. Mott was the person who really picked up on the significance of this and played it for all it was worth. I got into it in 1960, 1969, although I'd heard a little about it in 1968, probably a seminar by John Simon, which John was talking, and he talked later at the Conference on Liquid and Amorphous Semiconductors in 1969, which was held in Cambridge. He talked about how he knew that this was wrong and there was not a sharp localization transition. And he got jumped on by Moth and Anderson, according to his description of the situation. I have no reason to doubt it was true. He deserved it. He was jumped on and felt rather aggrieved about it. And I happened to go down to Bristol for purely domestic business, went round to the university campus, met John on the campus, I think. He took me to lunch, and I paid for my lunch by listening to his complaints about this and by promising to look into the question and see what I thought. So that was where I came into it, and I got sucked into this immediately. The original paper, I remind you or tell you what it was about. It looks at the standard Anderson model. You have a regular tight binding lattice with a fixed hopping matrix element going between nearest neighbors and with an energy of the sites which is randomly distributed. And Phil took the case of uniform distribution, but that detail was not important. He used perturbation expansion in powers of the ratio of the Hopping matrix to the width of the random distribution. That is, the zero order limit was the limit in which the site energy was dominant, and the Hopping matrix was the perturbation. And his argument showed very convincingly, although not rigorously, that if the Hopping matrix was small relative to the spread, to the amount of disorder, that all the states in the system would remain localized, and that as you increase the Hopping matrix relative to the amount of disorder, you would eventually get the localization breaking down. And the more familiar situation, most of us who were brought up in metal physics were familiar with, that you get block wave, essentially diffusive block wave states. The thing that we all have, many of us have taught and all have learnt as a basis of traditional solid state physics. The tricky part of the argument that Phil went through is, and it comes up again in Mott's work, the tricky part of the argument is that if you've got a very large system, there will always be states arbitrarily close in energy to the number you first thought of. So there's always a possibility that the perturbation theory will break down. What you have to show, and what he argued qualitatively, is that as you go further and further away, indeed you reduce the energy level spacing, but you also increase much faster the Hopping matrix element between them. So one goes algebraically, essentially, with distance, and the other goes exponentially. And so the exponential wins out if the disorder is strong enough. So that's the basic argument. And this is where the buzzword for the mathematicians, the small denominator problem, comes in. And this problem was eventually the solution. Basically, Phil's solution was put into rigorous form by Jürgen Fröhlich and Tom Spencer, who took over techniques on the small denominator problem used in the Kolmogorov, Arnold, and Moser work, which was so important in the discussion of development of chaos in some fields. Okay, so that was the point. And one more thing I should say is that various people I mentioned Martin Tooth, but there were other people who did this. Borland at the National Physical Laboratory, Ishii in Japan, and I think there are a number of other people who did it, who showed that in one-dimensional, and there was certainly a mathematical proof by that stage, that in one-dimensional case, states were always localized, however weak the disorder. So that much was known, and then this was hard. It was hard to understand. I had the right background for understanding Phil's paper. I mean, the kind of perturbation theory he used, I was familiar with. But it was still hard work for me, but I found it fascinating, and I worked very quickly on it. I think I was more or less au fait with the argument within a couple of months, and had to just report back to John Simon that I in no way agreed with him. But there were a number of things that had brought it into the mainstream in the 10 years between 1958 and 1969. A work on localized magnetic moments by Anderson, by Kondo, or various other people who were interested in this. My first introduction to the subject was actually going to a talk by Walter Cohn on the difference between a metal and an insulator, where he used this idea that the ground, that the electrons in a metal were localized, were extended through the system. The electrons in an insulator were localized in particular where it matters, which is near the Fermi surface. That difference had not been put in that form that I knew. And then also there was a technology aspect. Ovshinsky of energy conversion devices was encouraged by various eminent physicists, Mott, Fritscher, and so on, who were arguing for the technological importance of amorphous semiconductors. It's a great story. Amorphous silicon is cheap. Crystalline silicon is relatively expensive. And if you could make convert solar energy into electrical power with amorphous semiconductors, that would be fine. There are serious problems. Doping the amorphous semiconductors was a difficult problem initially. And the big problem is the energy gap is awfully small, so it doesn't match the the frequencies of sunlight at all well, and so it is grossly inefficient. There was this analysis, I've mentioned Mott's frequent quotation, there's this analysis of the electrical properties of highly disordered and amorphous semiconductors, for which Mott got the Nobel Prize at the same time as Phil Anderson. And that got it much more into the mainstream. And then also there was another connection, which is the work on critical phenomena. I mentioned here people I knew well, one way or another, Cyril Dom, Michael Fisher, Valery Pokrovsky, Leo Kadnoff, and various others who collaborated with them or worked independently of them, who were making continuous studies of phase transitions. And so there was a rather firm idea of what happened as you went from one phase of matter to another, and a feeling that this should be applicable to the case, the localization, diffusive transition between insulators and metals. So that was the general situation, and I will say briefly that I suspect it came up before, but I knew about a couple of works in the period 1968-69, which showed that if you took the Lorentzian Cauchy distribution of energies in the model, You calculate the density of states, you could calculate it exactly, and nowhere was there a sign of a phase transition. So what was being argued was that there was a very important phase transition which was occurring without any signal in the density of states. The immediate reply by Anderson and by a number of other people, I mean, this is my instinctive first reply, is that the density of states depends on average of one particle Green's function. I dare say Phil didn't talk that language in those days. I certainly did. But conduction properties depend on the average of a two-particle Green function, as anybody knows who's looked at the formal derivations of the Kubo formula, worked also by Edwards and Greenwood, for electrical conductivity. There's a current-current correlation. It's two currents, not whereas the one-particle Green's function basically only involves one particle at a time. We felt very superior about this. There was an unfortunate event about 15 years later when, as we continued, or I certainly did, I don't know about the rest of people, teaching our students that the oscillatory spin-spin correlation function in a metal, the Rudiman, Cattell, Casilli, etc., oscillations, were exponentially damped by disorder. And then we came face to face with the work by Zuzin and Spivak, which Phil wrote a Physics Today article about, and that was how I learned about it, which said that our mistake about the Rudiman-Cattell oscillations rested on basically the same argument. It did not switch over to exponential localization. A 1 over r cubed cos 2kfr switched over to a 1 over r to the fourth when you took account of disorder. So, I mentioned this numerical work by MacKinnon in 1984, who showed that, as I suspected and had argued quite forcibly, but without a great deal of evidence in my favor, that the Cauchy distribution and the uniform distribution gave essentially identical results numerically. MacKinnon used the scaling argument, and in the little bit on the right-hand corner, you can see two plots, one for the Cauchy distribution, one for the uniform distribution, and there's a scaling length that comes that's used to rescale all the data. And it all fits on one nice curve in the main diagram there. Okay, so move on. The important thing is there really are sharp distinctions between localized and extended states. The electrical conductivity tends to a finite limit as a temperature goes to zero if the states around the Fermi energy are extended. Goes to zero exponentially for localized states. Mott argued about the nature of the temperature-dependent conductivity for localized states and came out with this famous result that the logarithm of the conductivity is inversely proportional to the 1 over t to the 1 quarter. And experimentalists duly went and plotted up all their data, and they all got nice straight lines when they plotted log sigma against t to the minus a quarter. But Efros and Shklovsky were telling us that the theory was wrong, and it should be 1 over t to the half. And I was on the wrong side of that argument, and Mott was certainly on the wrong side of that argument. And it took a little time to get the experimentalists interested, but they took the data down to lower temperatures, and they found that their t to the minus a quarter results crossed over to t to the minus a half, which is a moral story that experimentalists shouldn't listen too much to theorists, and theorists shouldn't be too happy when they get results that agree with experiment. Phil grins when I say that. Mott did not grin when I made similar remarks. One place I quoted this, I thought Mott wouldn't read, but he did read, and he was rather cross with me. It was a different context. But the most important theoretical development in the 70s, to my mind, was the development of a workable scaling theory, which I did my bit to start. I don't know why I wrote Licciardello and Thallus 1985. I think that's 1975. I wasn't working with Don Licciardello, and I think he dropped out of physics by that time. We had this idea that the strength of coupling between neighboring blocks, and the sort of real space renormalization group type of argument, that the strength of coupling was related to the conductivity, and the gang of four, Licciardello, Abrams, Anderson, and Ramakrishnan, put that together with a detailed analysis of what happens as you approach the conducting limit, and produce this scaling thing. And I'll just flip up the scaling diagrams in three, two, and one dimension for dimension less than two, namely one dimension. It always scales downhill. And having been lent a beautiful laser pointer, I'd better use it. It scales downhill to the localized state. For two dimensions, it looks as if it's going to be a conductor, and then eventually it does a nosedive and gets exponentially localized, whereas in three dimensions you can either go up this way to a real conductor or downhill to real localization. So that was that bit of the story. And don't know how much more about part of it I've shown with the diagrams. The smooth transition between localized and extended states, which this kind of renormalization theory or any scaling theory will lead to, suggests that Mott's idea of a minimum metallic conductivity, which I espoused at one time, that ought to be wrong. And the Joffe-Regel criterion that mean free paths should never be less than wavelengths must be wrong. And that was the remark I made, was that although there was strong experimental evidence for minimum metallic conductivity, there were very few theorists around who believed in it, which was perhaps tactless of me. So what more do I want to say? Be nice if we knew more about interacting systems, but we don't. They're obviously important. And of course, the way around it is being shown to you this afternoon. Well, if you can't describe real conductors, there's always a Coulomb interaction between charge carriers. You can't describe real conductions. You can think about other things like atomic systems and light scattering. But in solids, the combination of the Mott transition, which interactions are important, and the Anderson transition, in which the disorder is the only thing that matters, the real life must be involve a mixture between the two. Don't want to follow up the last remark on that. Experiments, particularly by Miriam Sarachik's group, shown metal insulator transitions at low dimensions, low temperatures in two-dimensional systems. And I'm not up to date on what the interpretation of that is. There's also an interest in Anderson localization and Mott localization in bosonic systems, which has particularly been revived by the work on dilute atomic systems. And one will expect there that repulsion between bosons will enhance both condensation attraction, ultimately produces disastrous collapse for the two-dimensional bosonic, for dilute bosonic systems. Well, my last half minute, I'd say that I moved on to the quantum Hall effect. Quantum Hall effect is a dramatic new bit of physics. I have 5 minutes more, don't I?
No.
Thank you for telling me now. Okay, I thought time had gone faster than it might have done. Okay, in which case, what I want to do, of course, is say more about the quantum Hall effect. A lot of my life has been in the last, well, basically since I went to University of Washington in 1980, has been tied up with that, at least for the first 15 years there. You get at low temperatures and high magnetic fields these very flat plateaus of the Hall conductance, either depending on the gate voltage on a MOSFET or on the magnetic field for heterojunction like gallium arsenide. And that these plateaus are accompanied by extremely low longitudinal resistance. And since conductance and resistance are matrices, low resistance means low longitudinal conductance as well. Electric fields then can induce edge currents, but they can also introduce bulk currents where all the states are localized. They drift as a result of the electric field. For a long time, Marcus Boetticher and I had arguments about which was the right mechanism or the important mechanism. It's fairly clear that both, either can happen. You can tell the difference. There are nice experiments, for example, showing potential gradients across a quantum Hall bar. Where there is a potential gradient, the electrons will be moving along the equipotentials, despite the fact that they're well away from the Fermi energy. So that's a place where new experiments have dramatically changed the way we look at things. And the way we were looking at things before has been important to us. What else do I want to say? I want to say thank you. And I'm stopping early thanks to thanks to Gloria's clock setting, which is good. It gives other people more time. I wanted to thank particularly the people who've influenced me over the time. Phil Anderson, of course, above all. We were in frequent communication about this when I was first working in it. He was in Cambridge. I had parents in Cambridge, so I commuted to Cambridge fairly often. Don Licciardello was a postdoc with me and then went to work with Phil. Neville Mott, who was had been my boss in Cambridge for a year, had paid no attention to what I was doing, but then I switched to his field of interest and I found him enormously helpful, enormously useful in discussions, and I thought he also organized marvelous conferences. And I want to thank Gloria and Dan for setting up this, and above all, once more, thank Phil for giving us all this fun in this and many other fields of physics. Thank you. Yeah, questions. Yep.
You wanna?
Questions? Sorry, yep.
Not really a question, but I think it would be helpful if the lighting went down, we would be able to see the projector a lot better.
Yes. It would have been even more helpful if you said that half an hour ago. But yeah, but maybe it will, maybe it won't happen. Any more serious questions than that one? Yeah, Phil.
One person you recognize here today is Rolf Landauer. I don't think one should neglect his contribution, although it began being this thing which was so obvious that everything would be in one dimension would be an insulator. But it ended up that probably the formalism he produced is more important as what I did.
Yeah, I completely agree with that remark. And yes, I'm sorry, I couldn't think of everything. And Rolf was, as far as I know, the most important omission that I have made. Rolf gave us new ways of thinking about conduction. He talked about the one-dimensional case. I should have listed him with Ball and these Ishii and these other people. Rolf was always very antagonistic to linear response theory and Kubo formula and so forth. I think his antagonism was a bit overdone, but his alternative approaches were enormously valuable.
I'm not sure it was overdone.
Yeah, okay. Well, you've been more exposed. Yeah. I think linear response theory used with restraint is a great approach, but you do have to be cautious, and many false conclusions have been drawn on the basis of linear response theory, including by me. So if there are no more questions, we have to have a short break.
6 minutes.
Yeah.
Not much time.
Yeah, it's very annoying when people start 6 minutes early.
Yeah.
Not as annoying as when a train starts.
Well, yeah.
David, you have a question.
Yeah.
I have a simple question. Don't see this.
Yeah.
You mentioned Navshinsky, but it was not clear. Was he excited about localization or he wanted to meet the localization?
Sorry, who?
Navshinsky.
No, he was excited about the localization because I think it's important for the training of semiconductors.
But in fact, there was localization.
You
have to make use of amorphous silica instead of crystalline silica.
No, it was not complete localization in crystalline silicon. It's a conductor that's not a very
strict. Can you?
I think the problem.
You use this because people.
Yes, I think it's asking about Obshinsky. Didn't follow it very closely at the time, although I heard a lot about it afterwards. One of the things about localization is that it gives you pinning of the Fermi energy, and that was very useful. And that's also important in the quantum Hall effect. So I think that both aspects are needed, both the localization in order to give you a pinned Fermi surface, not to have it floating around, just as compensation in a crystalline semiconductor stops things floating around too much. And the other thing is that if you create electron-hole pairs in the semiconductor, it will be nice for them to be sufficiently mobile that they'll recombine without losing too much energy. So, but I think both sides, both the localization and the delocalization, were important in Ovshinsky's ideas about technical about technical applications.